From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On any given day, more than 200,000 veterans find themselves sleeping on the streets they fought to protect. This year, as many as 800,000 will be homeless for some period of time. Many of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and drug addiction. To find out what happens to these lost soldiers, I visited the grounds of the largest Veterans Administration facility in the country, near the heart of Los Angeles. A medical helicopter takes off from the VA sprawling campus. In the middle of the campus stands a stately brick building with arched windows, built in the 1920s. It's home to New Directions, a nonprofit organization separate from the VA that's helped thousands of homeless veterans get back on their feet.
No. My name is
Murray Wood meets us in the lobby. He's broad-shouldered with glasses and the look of a man who's found his passion. Wood gave up a lucrative university job to become New Directions' head of development and PR.
Where we're standing today, there are more veterans within 42 miles of where we're standing than in 42 states of the Union.
That's 42 states combined. As Wood describes what goes on here, behind closed doors, his enthusiasm is palpable.
New Directions is a place literally of transition and transformation, of people who have once been with their families, once been having jobs, gainful, then going into the military, then getting out, somehow then falling down on their luck, and then they're on their way back, and we see transformations.
To prove his point, Wood introduces me to Todd Roberts, a resident manager.
Todd, how long have you been here at New Directions?
I've been here coming up on a year now, about 1 week from here.
Like 95% of New Directions employees, Roberts was once a resident. Before that, the former Marine was homeless and addicted to heroin.
I was actually living out on the streets in a tent on the side of a freeway. And my parents, who happened to live in Montana, retired out there, they came out to find me. And one morning I came outside my tent, and there they were standing there. So that was a real eye awakening for me.
Roberts has only been clean a year, but says he's determined to stay that way. One reason many troubled veterans turn to drugs or alcohol is to numb emotional pain. Dr. Michael Buffington, a clinical psychologist at New Directions, says combat can create fresh emotional wounds as well as exacerbate old ones, even from childhood.
For example, you can take a group of 10 guys on average, send them into combat. Two will come back with some significant trauma. Two will come back with no symptoms at all, and the other guys will be mid-range. And that's usually predicated on who they were going in and whether they volunteered or didn't.
My journey through New Directions began where it does for homeless veterans, on the third floor, in detox.
Hello.
Again, my name is Anthony. Welcome to the assessment center.
Anthony Belcher runs intake. That's where veterans from the street who want help entrust themselves to men who've walked this road before.
A veteran can walk in here at any time of day, any time of night, and if we've got a bed, he can get a bed.
As soon as a veteran arrives, he's asked for his life history, including drug and alcohol use. Then he begins a detox that can last up to 21 days. The staff psychologist assesses him for mental illness. The results of that evaluation determine where he'll end up next, in a 12-step residential program or in a building next door for vets suffering from addiction and trauma.
We're called the last house on the block. So when guys get here, the average, I would say, is at least 15 years of active use. We've got guys that have been in and out of prisons, long-term homelessness. So here, the biggest obstacle to anyone is just believing that, you know, if I invest this time, is it going to do me any good?
One of the testaments to that sentiment is the life of Sharon Frochin, which took a sharp downturn after she left the Air Force.
In the Valley, I was running drugs for the Aryan Nation, and I came to the women's house, and the majority of the women in the women's house are African American, and I was the minority, which was a brand new thing to me. And the 11 months that I spent in the program gave me the opportunity to see how stupid that was.
Now Frochin is not only clean and sober, she is also one of New Directions' chief fundraisers. It takes millions of dollars a year to keep the organization going. And 3 years ago, New Directions received a grant from the federal government to launch an innovative program for veterans who are both traumatized and substance abusers. A new report from the Federal Government Accountability Office has some veterans' advocates worried. It found that only 1 in 5 troops returning from Iraq or Afghanistan who were considered at risk for post-traumatic stress disorder were actually referred for treatment by the Department of Defense. After they're discharged, some of these troops whose problems go untreated could end up on the streets. But there is good news, says Peter Dougherty, director of Homeless Veterans Programs with the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Back when Vietnam was going on, we didn't have any community-based centers, vet centers, if you will, for veterans to come in and receive counseling from other war veterans.
In fact, at New Directions, residents refer to each other and their counselors as family. And the experiences shared within this family, on the benches in the hallway or around the bright red piano in the dining room, inspire veterans who had once given up on themselves to believe again. Fundraiser Sharon Froschen has not only reconciled with her family, but with herself.
You never understand what it's like to have something save your life until it's done it. And I have experienced that with New Directions, and my sense of loyalty to New Directions goes a long, long way.
Just when you thought it was over, the Democratic circus continues. Saturday's Democratic National Committee meeting ruled that the contested delegates of Michigan and Florida would be split between the two candidates. Plus, Hillary Clinton wins the Puerto Rico primary, getting twice as many votes as Barack Obama. To make sense of this weekend's political events, we have our regular political contributor, Donna Brazil. She's a Democratic strategist and a nationally syndicated columnist. Great to have you on today.
It's wonderful to talk to you.
Okay, Donna, you're an uncommitted superdelegate and a member of the Democratic Party's Rules and Bylaws Committee. So this weekend you guys met to decide the delegate situation with Michigan and Florida. We're going to get to what you decided in a second, but it looks like it was a little bit of a zoo.
No, it was not. We deliberated privately on Friday night to look at what some of our options were. Clearly, we had strong supporters from both the Clinton campaign as well as the Obama campaign. At the end of the day, we did straw polls just to get a sense of where everything stood. And there were three crucial votes. Of course, the vote to overturn our initial ruling, which penalized the two states for defying the rules. And we thought it was very important to be fair to the process and the integrity of the process since we're at the end of the process. And two other votes, of course, once we decided that our sanctions would remain in place, we decided that the best way to look at the challenges, of course, was to see how we could fairly deal with the situation in light of the fact that we have two candidates and they're still competing for the nomination. The Florida situation was quite easy when you think about what was at stake. And the reason why I say that is because Senator Obama's name, along with Senator Clinton's name, appeared on the ballot, and we took the recommendation from the Florida Democratic Party to give each of the delegates a half vote. Once we secured the votes for that, and you saw it was almost unanimous, we proceeded to Michigan. Well, let me just say, we did not have a resolution on Michigan, and it took us a whole day of hearings to listen to the Michigan challenge, to listen to both the Clinton campaign as well as the Obama campaign. And neither proposal, the Clinton proposal, did not have the sufficient votes. The Obama proposal was tied. I did not wish to break a tie that would leave us with a 14-13 vote. So we went to the Michigan proposal, which had the backing of both the Clinton campaign as well as the Obama campaign, and that was the compromise. Had we approved the Clinton plan as is, she would have netted 9 delegates. Had we approved the Obama plan, it would have been a wash because it would have been 50-50. We came up with something in between, and she netted a plus 5. Over the weekend, she netted close to 22-24, and he had to take a hit in both places. I think we came up with a win-win for both campaigns because we backed the Michigan plan. It wasn't the Clinton plan. It wasn't the Obama plan. And despite the theatrics in the room with passionate supporters from both sides. We really came out of our deliberations very unified.
So just give me the numbers. Who's got how many delegates?
Well, as of today, Senator Obama is the new number, the new metric to look at, without getting into who has what numbers, is 2118. We added 92 more delegates that some were awarded, some are still up for grabs because there are superdelegates involved as well as pledged delegates. And in order to clinch the nomination, you need 2128. Senator Clinton needs about 203. Senator Obama needs about 45. There are 31 delegates remaining at stake tomorrow in the two remaining primaries in South Dakota and Montana. And sometime, we hope, within the next 48 to 72 hours, one of the candidates will achieve the magical number. There are about 200 superdelegates that are uncommitted, undeclared, but I hesitate to believe that they're undecided. They may have some other political reasons for not wanting to come forward. But let's see what happens tomorrow night, and then we'll see. We'll talk on Wednesday to get the verdict.
We're going to have to go to a break in a second, but do you feel like this was a victory, just quickly?
Yes. As a member, it was a victory.
All right, Donna, I just want you to stay with us. We are talking to Donna Brazile, who's an undeclared superdelegate and also was on the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee that met this weekend in order to decide exactly how people would be seated in Michigan and Florida. We're going to be back with her in a second and also talk to Julianne Malvo, economist, about how your next trip on a plane could cost you more than you think. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We have got Donna Brazile, our regular political commentator, who's going to keep talking to us about what's been going on with the Democratic Party. She is a Democratic strategist and a nationally syndicated columnist. Welcome back. And Donna, let me go straight to a little bit of one of the candidates' words. Senator Clinton lacks the delegate she needs to win the nomination, yet she says she's ahead in the popular vote. Here's what she said after winning the primary in Puerto Rico.
Winning the popular vote. Now there can be no doubt. The people have spoken and you have chosen your candidate.
So if she actually has won more of the popular vote, is this going to undermine Senator Obama's lead in the delegate count?
No, ma'am, it will not. And here's why. First of all, the metric that everyone should focus on is who is leading in the delegate vote. This is not about who is leading the popular vote or who won the most states which states carry more electoral weight. Our rules, this is a nominating contest, not a beauty contest. And so the rules stipulate that you have to win the most delegates. Now, can Senator Clinton use her argument that she won the most popular vote? And I'll put an asterisk behind winning the most popular vote, because here's why I believe a victory was achieved on Saturday. Senator Obama abided by the rules. And we said that Michigan and Florida would not count. He did not campaign in those states, although some argue that he ran advertisement, national advertisement, which if you live in certain parts of the country, you're running in Mississippi, you're here in Louisiana, you're running in California, you're here in Nevada. He ran national advertisement, and people in Florida may have seen it on CNN, MSNBC, and whatever network he ran it on. But the truth is, neither candidate ran campaigns in those two states. So Senator Clinton, by virtue of the fact that we now have sanctioned those two contests, which, as I said on Saturday, that constitutes cheating when 48 states and the District of Columbia and the other jurisdictions abide by the rule. We reopen the rules and change the rules of the game at the end of the process. That's called cheating. But we did it because we wanted to achieve party unity. But now Senator Clinton is using the results of those two states to add to her total and popular vote. But they are now denying Senator Obama the opportunity to add any of the uncommitted, because we don't know exactly how they voted, or the write-in, because we don't know how they're voted, because they're not tabulated. And they're not adding the people who actually went to the caucuses in five crucial states. So these are arguments that people use for their talking points. But they are not arguments that should be used in any way to convey that Senator Obama, if he's the nominee, is somehow or another illegitimate. He's not. If he wins the most delegates, he is the nominee. If Senator Clinton wins the most delegates, she is the nominee. And look, we have two great candidates. I've never been more excited in my life as a woman who has worked all her adult life in politics and as a minority who had to fight to get in the door. I've never been so proud of my party and what we've achieved as a country and seeing these two candidates compete for the nomination. Tomorrow, Tuesday, June 3rd, 5 months from when this process started in January, our nominating contest will come to an end and someone will lead in delegates. And that's the only metric that matters.
Donna, you said yesterday on CNN that you would finally break your silence and go ahead and announce who you were pledging your superdelegate support to on Wednesday. So you're going to be back on our show on Wednesday. Can you give us the first scoop on who you're going
to
pick?
Well, you know, I tend not to go to bed on election nights until about 3 or 4 in the morning. And this has been, as you can imagine, one of the most difficult, as much excitement as I have for both candidates. I have to make a decision. I'm a superdelegate. The power invested in me as a superdelegate, of course, is to declare or to stay undeclared. I prefer to declare for the simple reason that I would like to bring this nominating process to an end so that we, as a party, as a country, can begin to repair what I call the cracks in our foundation from a very exciting political process. And look, I've been in winning campaigns. I've been in losing campaigns. I've been in campaigns where we thought we didn't have no shot, and we became the big shot. And I want to be able to help the nominee, whoever he or she is, begin the healing process starting this week.
All right. Well, we look forward to having you on Wednesday, and we really want to know exactly what's going to happen. So save us some good stuff. Thanks, Donna.
This is like a gumbo. I'll hold some of my best ingredients until I talk to you again.
All right.
God bless you.
You too. Thanks,
Thank
Donna.
You.
That was Donna Brazil, our regular contributor. She was on the Democratic National Committee's Rules, National Commission's Rules and Bylaws Committee, and she's going to be back on Wednesday to tell us who her pick is. First, there was no food on short flights. Then you had to pay for food on long flights. Then fares went way up because of fuel prices. And now one airline has started charging $15 to check your first piece of luggage. And other airlines are thinking of following suit. So what the heck is going on with airfares? Here to fill us in is Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She's an economist and also the president of Bennett College. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you, Farai?
Oh, you know, I fly a lot. I might now have to, strap things on my body and, wear two pairs of underwear and five pairs of
FedEx,
shoes.
FedEx, your toiletries.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. So, you know, why are airlines just, you know, pretty much desperate for any penny they can get?
Well, first of all, with gas prices being what they are, they have a cost they didn't expect. But secondly, we've seen our airline industry limping along, certainly for the last couple of years. And this, what's so awful about right now is it's summer when we expect air travel to go up, discretionary travel to go up. Families are looking at what they're going to do this summer, and more of them are saying, we're going to take a driving vacation. Well, with gas at $4 a gallon plus, that's even challenging. But when you look at what you've got going on, you see the airline industry more costly. They're beginning to penalize business travelers again. I paid $1,000 to go from D.C. to Greensboro round trip. $1,000. That's absurd. I could be in Europe right now. But that's the name of the game. If you fly at the last minute, the fares are higher. They've reinstituted the Saturday stay, which I think discriminates against business travelers. the paying for luggage makes it easier for people to look at these baggage services, Farai. There are many of them that will charge you $50 to FedEx your luggage or send it by some other courier across the country. So it's become much more difficult, but it's really being driven by economics, first of all, in terms of the gas prices, but secondly, in terms of the weakness in this industry that's been a weakness since September 11th of 2001.
I want to talk more about the larger ramifications of this for the economy in a second. But first off, this is travel time. People are planning family vacations, and there's some things you can drive to and some things you can even take the bus to. But there's a lot of places folks want to go to see family or see sites that require plane travel. So what's on the side of the traveler these days? What things might help a traveler out?
First of all, planning early. You still can get pretty reasonable fares when you're 14, 21, even 30 days out, getting on those travel sites and looking for the Best Buy, looking for alternative airports. I like to fly out of Greensboro, for example, but I can cut $300 or $400 off a ticket if I go out of Raleigh-Durham. Many people in the Washington area, many of us like to go out of Washington National, but Baltimore or Dulles also provide you with a cheaper ticket. So people should be encouraged to look at alternative airports. Also, you know, people like to JetBlue, ATA, Southwest, they're considered the second-tier airlines, but those second-tier airlines now have better prices for lots of people and sometimes more flexibility. If you buy a ticket today for Ryan and you have to change it, on the major airlines, US Air, Delta, American, United, you've got a $150 change fee. Some of the other airlines don't charge as high a change fee, and some don't charge any at all. So the savvy traveler who's got to get to that wedding across the country or really promised someone that they were going to get to a graduation or something like that really needs to look at 30 days out and not being wedded to any airlines. Do not plan to get anywhere on your frequent flyer points if you're going at the last minute. They're going to tack on so many extra charges that you're going to wish you paid for the fare. But in addition, airlines are making fewer frequent flyer seats available. So you're sitting on top of a couple 100,000 miles thinking you're going to be able to take your family across country. Not necessarily.
All right. Well, I was booking some wedding-related travel, and I booked a flight to Fayetteville, Arkansas. But the first Fayetteville that popped up was Fayetteville, North Carolina. I almost booked a flight there, and from what I understand, I would have had to change within 24 hours or they would have charged me a bunch of fees. But aren't there some upsides to booking online?
There are lots of upsides to booking online. It's the best and fastest way to do that comparison shopping thing. You just got to make sure, don't let your fingers push the buy button until you're certain that everything there is what you really want from time of day to the airport that you're going into. But Orbitz, Travelocity, and some of those other bargain sites really do give you a good sense of what your options are, as opposed to calling around to your favorite airlines or some other airlines. You can still book with your favorite airlines, but if you're counting pennies, you owe it to yourself to look at every option you have.
Yeah, there's also another one. There's Kayak and Sidestep. You know, there's a whole bunch of choices. Everyone picks theirs, but I kind of go and try different ones at different times to see what they kick back to me. Let's move out from this consumer side to the broader side of macroeconomics. What do you think this is going to do, these changes in fares and these changes in policy for the airline industry, but then also the ripple effect to the national economy?
Well, I think the issue really is the economy, the industry certainly. But when you look, when people say that they're not going to fly, it costs the economy money. Economists are estimating as much as $26 billion this summer because people are saying, I'm just not going to fly. And so think about that as money that's not in the market, money that's going somewhere else. Now, some of it, obviously, someone doesn't fly. Maybe they drive. Someone doesn't go on this vacation and stay at a hotel. Maybe they go to another city and stay at a hotel. So some of it will wash out. But about 50% of it for Rye is just lost revenue. What that means is that people who work in hotels and amusement parks, you know, all of the tourist-related industries, they're going to probably see a little bit of a slump in the number of dollars that are coming to their industry. So lots of people, as in this economy, which is slowing despite what people want to say, lots of people are going to find fewer tips, fewer dollars. This hits our young people especially because lots of young people work in travel and tourism in the summer. And so the youth unemployment issue that we've talked about in this program before is something that's going to be affected by the whole issue of what's happening with travel. Our economy is, it's almost like looking at a quilt and all these intertwined pieces. And so nothing happens by itself. So those people who are looking at travel say, oh, well, the airlines, you know, they're gouging us. The fact is, yet maybe they are. But these airlines are an integral part of our nation's economy. Travel and tourism represents more than 7% of our national economy. That's how to look at it.
When you think about the fuel costs that have risen just astronomically, for the first time, I have a pretty energy-efficient car, fuel-efficient car, I paid $60 for the first time on my tank. And it was not that long ago. It wasn't like decades ago. It was just maybe a year ago I was paying $35 to fill my tank. But when you think about how much it costs to fill a jet, what do we see ahead for those fuel prices that are really driving the industry down?
Well, we know that fuel prices are not likely to go down precipitously anytime soon. They've been fluctuating, but I don't think that they're going to go down anytime soon. So we're looking at, again, more permanent higher fares. You're looking at a number of other places where you see fuel surcharges, mail services and other things like that where fuel surcharges are taking place. So we're looking at pressure on the economy for people who commute to their jobs. As you say, filling up a tank at $60 that used to be $35, it's a bit of a shock. If you do it just occasionally, that's not a big deal. But if you're filling up that tank, you know, once or twice a week to get to work, that makes a difference. Again, people are making discretionary decisions. In our cities, in our major cities, what we've already seen is increased ridership on public transportation. We never thought we'd be able to get Americans out of their cars for public transportation, but with gas prices at $4 a gallon, I think we've seen that happen. So, but what kind of pressure does that put on a city? Some of our urban public transportation systems are already pretty fully utilized, and so you're crowding in cars and all of that. The quality of life because of the increase in fuel prices has declined.
Now, you mentioned that people are going to change the way that they drive. Do you think that when the airlines shake this off, hopefully, at some point, a lot of people will just be fed up and will do whatever they can not to travel by air and permanently change their travel patterns, maybe where they go on vacations or how they plan things out, and that there will be a long-term effect of this even when the airlines start making more money?
Well, we certainly did see a very long recovery from September 11th. Certainly that was not the airline industry's fault. It was an act of terrorism that changed the way that we travel, a number of things around security, making travel less pleasant than it had been before. And it took them a very long time to bounce back. This, if the industry decides to change its fare structure as fuel prices go down, I don't think that we'll have a permanent disengagement from air travel. Americans are very mobile people, and it doesn't take much with all of our destination travel and other things to get people to travel. But the fare structure, I think, is where you've seen a lot of people draw the line. It's also a whole bunch of service-related issues, lost luggage, missed arrangements. The industry didn't do itself any service at the end of April when it sidelined thousands of trips because equipment had not been serviced. So they're going to have to woo the public back, but I think it's a public that can be easily wooed.
Very quickly, do you have any thoughts of how you should address complaints, if you have them, to airlines?
Well, you know, the FAA has a complaint structure. You start out with the airline itself. You start out with your local market where you traveled, but you make sure that their customer service people get in touch with you or you get in touch with them. And you've got to be extremely persistent. They don't always get back to people. The FAA certainly is an option. There's a case that's floating around on the internet now where a man is suing, I believe, Delta Airlines for $1 million. His family was stranded on their way to I want to say Chile. It's a Latin American country, but they were stranded for his mother's 80th birthday. And he alleges that the airline employee laughed in his face after he missed the connection. So he's suing for $1 million. That's extreme. And that obviously most of us don't have the time, effort, energy, or money to take it to the courts. But there is a well-thought-out complaint process, and there are lots of websites and advocacy organizations that will help people. My experience has been that the airlines will generally respond, although sometimes very slowly, and you've really got to be extremely persistent. Don't go after them because of something small, because it's not going to make a difference. You're going to get frustrated. But if your luggage is lost, if your connection was missed, if you really have had material damage, go after them.
All right, Dr. Malveaux, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was author and economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She is also president of Bennett College and joined us from WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Coming up, remembering the great Bo Diddley. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. The Democratic Party makes some big decisions, and Barack Obama resigns from his church. We've got that and more on our Bloggers Roundtable with novelist and screenwriter Trey Ellis. He blogs for The Huffington Post and Babbel.com. Marjorie Valbrun, who is a contributing writer for TheRoot.com. She also blogs as Double X or XX Factor at Slate.com. Plus Robert Redding of the RedingNewsReview.com. Hi, folks.
Hello.
So the Democratic Party's Rules Committee decided to split the Florida and Michigan delegates between the two candidates. The move didn't sit well with the Clinton camp, even though she ended up getting more of those delegates. And things got heated at the meeting. Clinton supporters were screaming and chanting, "No Obama" and "Let's go McCain." Earlier in the show, we spoke with our contributor, Donna Brazil. She serves on the Rules Committee. But during the meeting, here's part of what she said. All right, we have that coming up, a little bit of what she said during the meeting. But meantime, before we pull that up, because Donna is always hilarious, I'm going to ask you, Marjorie, there were some incredible comments that came out of this. There was a woman who said that Barack Obama, and said this very publicly into a camera, was an unqualified black male. What do you make of the divisions in the party?
I think it's really troubling. I think he's going to have his work cut out for him if he, in fact, becomes a nominee, which appears pretty likely. But I don't think it helps, you know, relations between black voters and white voters, particularly white feminists and black women. And I think that, you know, they keep trying to frame the argument as him not being qualified rather than, you know, her not being satisfied with not being the nominee. And I was very troubled by some of the language they used during the DNC meeting. Harold Ickes used the word affirmative action, which, you know, is a buzzword for race. And I thought it was really unfortunate and ugly. I was very disturbed by the whole thing. But I don't think it helps Clinton with Barack's supporters either.
Trey, let's listen to a little bit of Donna Brazil.
But my mama always taught me to play by the rules and to respect those rules. And my mother also taught me. And my mother also taught me.
Please,
and I am sure your mother taught you, because you are clearly a fine man and a public servant that I've admired for years, that when you decide to change the rules, especially middle of the game, end of the game, that is referred to as cheating.
Trey, when you think about that, you know, that's some pretty tough talk from Donna, and there was tough talk from all quarters here. What do you think is, I mean, if you can put on your, you know, your kind of thought bubble to the future, once the primaries are wrapped up, do you think that Senator Clinton will bow down to pressure to leave for the good of the party, as some people argue, if she does not have enough of the delegates?
I think, you know, she's been negotiating these terms of her surrender for weeks now. And I think she's got to be coming to terms with it and understand that her supporters have been so classless in how they have comported themselves, not only on Saturday but before that, that I think outsiders have got to pull their coat a little bit and say, this is bigger than this election. Your legacy, it really stands in judgment now. And you can be an elder statesman in your party and have a fine career after this if you do the right thing. And she's really at a crossroads right now.
In fact, Senator Obama said something along those lines. He gave a section of his speech where he was describing her as a great public servant, et cetera, et cetera. Robert, do you think that was a gentle or not so gentle brush off? It's kind of like, thanks for playing, now leave.
Well, no, I think it's definitely an overture for her to be the stateswoman that she can be at this point and do the right thing. I think it's very troubling that the Democratic Party, which I used to be a part of, now an independent, has gone down this road. But I think blacks finally are seeing that it's not Fox News that did this. It's not that some conservative right-wing agenda did this. This is the Democratic Party imploding from the inside out, and this is where character is really going to come into play here, whether she has it, and I don't think she does. One of the things that's a very misleading statement that she said is that the decision violates the bedrock of our democracy and our party. That's not true. Our democracy has nothing to do with delegates and how our political parties are structured. It has nothing to do, the Constitution has nothing to do with political parties and doesn't even speak to political parties. As a matter of fact, George Washington, the former president of the United States, of course the first president of the United States, warned about political parties. So these are just very misleading statements, and she's extremely self-serving, and I think people are finally seeing the Clintons for what they really are, and that's only out for self and not out for anyone else except themselves.
Now, all of you are black. This is a show that focuses on African-American issues. Do you think that the perspective of white America, whether or not, I mean, not white America, white Americans, is different fundamentally? Whether or not you're talking about Obama supporters or Clinton supporters or McCain supporters, do you think that white Americans or non-black Americans generally read the racial politics of this differently?
I do, yeah.
Absolutely.
How so?
Well, I think, you know, we come from different points of view, and this Obama campaign has really been a litmus test for so many of us. But, you know, that goes back to his being biracial as well. I mean, it really, people see in him what they want to see. And certainly black people now see a black man, and which in a way that they were not quite so sure they saw a black man when he first began his campaign.
Well, you know, speaking of the biracial issue, he's, of course, the son of an African immigrant and a white woman from Kansas. And to some folks, he really is biracial, but he acknowledges that and still refers to himself very much as an African-American man. Marjorie, you recently wrote a column for TheRoot.com, and you talked about Oprah Winfrey and Obama being in a certain, you know, heightened, rarefied sphere for black people and to many white Americans, transcending race. What do you mean by that?
Well, I've never really brought into this term of transcending race, but I think the way it's been used in this campaign is that for some people, you know, they don't really see him as black. And I've heard that so many times from white people I've interviewed. Well, he's not really black. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, in the traditional sense. And I think for some people that means that, you know, he's post-civil rights. He doesn't have the quote-unquote racial baggage of, I guess, of other political leaders or black candidates like, you know, Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton. And from others, they just think that somehow they can relate to him because, you know, he has maybe a background like them, not in terms of his upbringing, but his education and his work and his you know, economic status. But I think that there are some people who do see him as black and who say that doesn't matter. You know, this whole thing about race doesn't matter, which I think that most black people don't buy into that because we know in America race always matters, and that's why this race has gone on for so long. But I think that there are others who feel that he is the best candidate, his race doesn't matter to them, and they feel very proud of themselves for embracing him. And I think that a lot of white Americans want to, in their mind, to get beyond race, which I don't know that we can, but I think that they see this as a chance for this country to do something great and big.
Robert, we talked a little bit last week about the number of black independents who were running this time around, Cynthia McKinney and several other people. Do you have a sense of how race is playing out in those races, since you yourself are a political independent?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that. Bob Barr, who is black, who doesn't admit to the fact that he's black, he sounds like the opposite of Barack Obama.
I can neither support nor deny that assertion. It has never been proven, so that's your opinion.
See, you know, that's the thing. In Georgia, we've always been from Georgia, Atlanta specifically, and we've always known this, and that's the thing that really kind of rubs people the wrong way, which we thought Barack Obama, some people thought Barack Obama was going to come at running for president. And, you know, but I think that it has not, to answer the question, materialized, the race issue hasn't materialized as obviously as it has in the Democratic sphere. But that just tells you the underlying problems. As I've always said, you take two lines leaving the KKK rally, one going left, one going right, the Democratic Party going left and the Republican Party going right. At the end of the day, they're both filled. These parties are both filled with people that hate black people, don't want to see black people in positions of power within their particular parties. And the Republicans have been accused of this more than the Democrats, and we're seeing a fair share now of this in the Democratic realm and in the Democratic sphere. I think that this also exists within the independence movement as well. I haven't seen as much evidence of this, but only time will bear that out.
Trey, let's move on to another topic. There are more preacher problems for Senator Obama. First of all, he quit his church, and then the Reverend Michael Flagler mocked Hillary Clinton for getting teary-eyed before the New Hampshire primary. And during his sermon, he pretended to be Clinton crying. He said Clinton thought white privilege was enough to give her the nomination. This is a reverend who has been a friend of Reverend Wright, who used to be Senator Barack Obama's pastor. Now, Senator Obama condemns the whole sort of acting game with the Clinton mocking, just as he did Wright's comments back in April. Overall, do you think that Senator Obama is probably fed up at this point with his various church-related issues? And do you think, on the other side, that his quitting the church, even more so than renouncing his former minister, could be viewed by some in the African-American community as being cowed or even a betrayal?
It's funny, when the Reverend Wright, when he first began his book tour, I had friends who were showing me Father Flagler's defending him and saying that Wright was misunderstood and they were trying to rally behind Reverend Wright. And I said, you guys are crazy to rally behind this guy who is obviously grandstanding because his protege is getting the limelight now. And then I think the black community really switched on a dime, I think, and really realized that the greater good, the bigger good of having an African-American president of the United States is bigger than this kind of solidarity to this group that can't sort of think in sort of politics 101, understand what you have to do to get somebody elected, and how self-serving and how sort of impolitic some of these comments can be at a really delicate time. It's not brain surgery. So I think that the black community is going to give Obama a pass on this and understand that this is not just that this is for real. This is not like a Jesse Jackson campaign, which is more symbolic. This is a real thing.
Marjorie Roland Martin of CNN was just saying yesterday that he doesn't expect the Obamas to choose another church until the election, kind of see how things roll out. But is not being affiliated with a church when Senator Obama has made much of his Christian faith, is that a downside?
I'm not sure that it is. I think that, you know, first of all, he's not going to have time to find a new church, and I think that this church thing has just been such an albatross around his neck that it probably would be a safer, frankly, political bet not to join a church. I disagree a little bit. I think that some black people will see it as a betrayal, but I also think that some people will think he's doing the church a favor as well because they've gotten so much negative publicity. But I think that, you know, he still speaks in terms of, you know, embracing his Christianity, and I suspect that he'll talk about that a bit more on the campaign trail. You know, but, you know, McCain has his own church problems, too, so maybe both of them will become, you know, agnostic after the election.
Or they'll join the same church, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, that's very likely.
Robert, do you think that Christianity is going to become a big factor in this election, as it has been in past ones?
Oh, absolutely. I think that this will now open up the door, him leaving the church, as to whether he was a Muslim in the first place, whether he's a Muslim, the fact that, of course, some members of the church, including the minister in question last Sunday, Flager, had this association with Farrakhan, whether he's a Muslim. Of course, you're going to hear this over and over again, and whether people believe it or not is another question. I believe that you can be a Christian without going to church, although you're considered a stronger Christian if you do go to church every Sunday, so it will continue to be an issue, I think.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were just speaking with novelist and screenwriter Trey Ellis. Trey blogs for The Huffington Post and Babbel.com. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York. Also with us was Marjorie Valbrun, who's also a contributing writer for TheRoot.com. She blogs for XX Factor at Slate.com. And Robert Redding of the ReddingNewsReview.com.
When I was a little boy, at the age of five.
We say goodbye to one of rock's founding fathers today, Bo Diddley. He created a pioneering guitar sound that helped turn rhythm and blues into rock. In the late 1960s and early 70s, groups like the Rolling Stones, the Velvet Underground, and Led Zeppelin claimed Diddley as an influence. A decade later, punk musicians took up his torch. The guitarist was the opening act for The Clash on its first U.S. tour. Bo Diddley was born Ellis Otha Bates on December 30, 1928, in Macomb, Mississippi. His family moved to Chicago when he was seven. There he saw guitar greats like John Lee Hooker and Muddy Waters. They inspired him to pick up an axe of his own. Diddley first began performing on street corners, and by 1951 he'd lined up a regular spot at the 708 Club. He also took on the name Bo Diddley, which some say is a play on the Southern slang for the term nothing at all. In 1955, Diddley found his way into a recording studio and recorded the song Bo Diddley. That song became a number one hit for Chess Records. Hey Bo Diddley and Who Do You Love followed.
I walk 47 miles of barbed wire. I use a cobra snake for a necktie. I got a brand new house on the roadside made from rattlesnake hide. I got a brand new chimney made on top, made out of a human skull. Now come on, take a little walk with me, Arlene, and tell me who do you love? Who do you love?
Diddley was also known for his signature rectangular guitar. Over his lifetime, he was honored with many, many awards. In 2004, Rolling Stone magazine ranked him 20th on their list of 100 most influential artists of all time. He was admitted to the hospital last May with a stroke and had a heart attack last August. He died today of heart failure at age 79 in his home in Archer, Florida.
May 21. Have a lot of fun. I'm a man.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, should race be a factor in who gets to adopt black kids? A coalition of child advocates says yes. We'll find out what they want to change and how it will affect the thousands of black children up for adoption.
In an hour's time.